This is going into the Slippery Rock Archives.
Okay.
So any future students of Slippery Rock will be able to, if they need to do a paper on baseball or whatever, they can go.
Okay. What we had to say, huh?
My whole class has to do a oral history on baseball.
Oh, my. So. Yeah. Good.
Okay, the first question I have is about the 1971 World Series.
Mm-hmm.
How did it feel winning that compared to when you won the World Series with the St. Louis Cardinals in 67?
Well, any World Series is really special. Just playing in the series is very, very special. Because not everyone, even though they play throughout a long career, has that opportunity. 1967 was special because that was the first time, and you really don't know what to expect. One of the things that was overpowering for me was the amount of press that were at the ballpark. I'm not talking hundreds, I'm talking thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1967, was with St. Louis, we played Boston. Well, every little newspaper in all of New England, you know, had a representative. So it was literally thousands of newspaper people that descended upon you and want to know all about you in the background. And of course, competition for readership is very intense, so they're all looking for special angles and everything else. But 67 was special because it was the first time. And I think growing up as a young boy, you might dream of being an all-star, and you might dream as a pitcher maybe winning 20 games, but the real number one dream is to play in a World Series. And then on top of that is to win the World Series. So the first time you go through that, that's an all-new experience and always remains special. In 19, and that was also the year before. That was a couple of years before playoffs were instituted. So if you won the pennant, then you went right into the World Series, and it started just 2 days later. You had one off day, and then the series started. 1971. It was the third year for the playoff system, and so winning your division was not the same as winning a pennant in 1967, because you still had, you know, another team to defeat before you get into the World Series. So it was added pressure, and we were able to defeat the Giants. So that got us into the World Series, and I think it just took longer to build, and it made winning your division a little more anticlimactic, because it didn't mean you got to the series. It mm-hmm. just meant that you were one step away. So winning the playoffs then really became very, very exciting. And then getting into the series. What was special about 1971 was the fact that we were such underdogs. Baltimore had four 20-game winners on their pitching staff. They had future Hall of Famers on their team with Brooks and Frank Robinson, and of course Jim Palmer and others. So they really got the publicity, and they were the media darlings. And those of us playing on the Pittsburgh club were astonished that we didn't get that much coverage or were given that much respect. And so when the series started, we weren't able to start with our two hottest pitchers, and that was Steve Blass and myself. And so we jumped out to leads in the first and second game, and our pitchers didn't make it to the third inning. And so when Baltimore won those first two games, they the media just had a field day. You know, Baltimore's going to win the series in three games, even though you have to play four. I guess they figured we'd forfeit one or something. But when we came from behind, came back to Pittsburgh, won all three games at home, Steve Blass winning the third, and then Bruce Keeson in relief winning the fourth, and then I won the fifth. All of a sudden, everybody said, hey, wait a minute, Pittsburgh could win this thing. And then to go ahead and win it in Baltimore, you know, was very special. And what's above media exposure and everything, what's really What really is so special about a World Series is the fact that it doesn't matter what you did all season long. All season long, all that did was get you to the series. Mm-hmm. And then it just depends on how well you perform in that little short period of time that can almost make or break your career. It at least will either enhance or detract from your reputation as a player and someone who can perform under extreme pressure. And for me, World Series play really enhanced my reputation as a pitcher who could play well under pressure, not only perform well, but exceed expectations. And that stayed with me my whole career.
Okay, what was the fans' perceptions of the team at that time? Do you feel they were more supportive of the Pittsburgh Pirates at that time than they are now, and even a few years ago when the Pirates had that string of their championships in this division?
Well, if you go back in Pirate history, the last time the Pirates had won anything was 1927. That was before the miracle of 1960. And then when the Pirates not only won the World Series in 1960, but it was against the Yankees. So that all the history of the great Yankee teams and the persona and mystique of the Yankees only enhanced the World Series victory by the Pirates. But from 1960 until 1971, well, actually 1970, the Pirates hadn't won. In 1970, the Pirates won their division, but it was with almost a totally new team of young players that they had signed and developed, with the exception of players like Bill Mazeroski, Willie Stargell, and Roberto Clemente. Almost all of the rest were new from 1969 on. And so this indeed was a whole new team. And the fans of Pittsburgh were pretty excited about these young players because they could, living up to Pirate reputation, they were exceptional hitters. And the people of Pittsburgh seemed to like that. And what needed to be added was some extra pitching. And so the general manager at that time, Joe Brown, went out and he made a big trade in 1970, like an 8-player deal, and got some pitching. And Dave Justy had been traded from St. Louis to Pittsburgh in 1970. Then I came over in just before spring training of 71 to add depth to the pitching staff. And indeed, it was the pitching that really turned the corner for the Pirates, and I think turned them into world champions. So the people accepted that team very, very well. And we won our division again in 72, finished third in 73. And then in 1974, there started to be a little bit of a turnover in personnel. And that happened all the way up and through 79, the next World Championship, when you had a new relief corps, you had basically a new pitching staff, and you had about the same turnover that was experienced from 60 to 71 as from 71 to 79. But I think the fans accepted the team, never broke the attendance record of 1960, which was 1,000,007. So our attendance records didn't reflect the fanaticism. But I think in those days, you didn't market as much as you do today and didn't have as many special events. And the business side of baseball wasn't as important. And the business side, including promotions and marketing to the fans, that just was an undeveloped area. And in the 90s, our organization received awards for its marketing and getting fans to the ballpark. And so in the early 90s, we did break attendance records and, drawing over 2 million, getting to over 2.5 million, as a matter of fact. And I think there was as much excitement in winning divisions in 90, 91, 92 as there was in winning world championships in 1971, 79.
I remember the first year they won the division, my sister and I went to the airport, and it was absolutely packed.
Yeah.
So I could see the excitement, the people there. Do you think it's that people perceive the Pirates as not having been a terribly successful baseball team throughout their history. It seems to me like a lot of people don't realize how much success this franchise has had throughout the history.
The success, there was a huge gap for a long period of time. And like I mentioned, between 1927 and 1960, very little success. Matter of fact, the team in the 50s was called the Rinky Dinks. The gentleman who turned out to be the trainer for the Pirates in the 70s, Tony Bartiromo, played first base on that team. And didn't have any power and didn't hit much for average, but held the record for never hitting into a double play in one season. That's because he couldn't hit. so you have to hit into double plays. But after 1960, the Pirates remained very competitive. All the way through the present day, with exception of 3 or 4 years in the mid '80s, when the ball club almost left Pittsburgh. But what Pittsburgh was remembered, especially by the older generations, was that period of time between 1927 and 1960 when not much happened, and that there weren't a lot of good players. The good players that came through were traded and moved on, and so there wasn't a lot to shout about. But 1960 seemed to be the turning point, and Pittsburgh was very competitive in the middle to late 60s, and then of course in the decade of the 70s, the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Cincinnati Reds were the ones who won a division every year, or won the World Championship, or won the pennant, just almost the whole decade of the 70s. And then Pittsburgh early 80s was competitive, and then rebuilt in the later part of the 80s. And now in the 90s, we've been winning. So we're looking now at going through a transition period, probably even through 95, and we're looking at 1996 of starting you know, another young team that's going to be very, very competitive and possibly win, just like we did in 90, 91, 92.
So how much do you contribute the success of the Pirates recently to Joe Moreland?
Well, I think with if you're an organization that brings up a lot of young players and count on young players producing, the leadership, your field leadership, becomes all important. Because young players have questionable confidence, and that confidence can rise and fall almost on a game basis. They're not mature as to how they manage their lives and their approach to the game of baseball. And so it takes somebody with very special skills to manage these young people, to keep them inspired, to keep them in line, to discipline without losing respect. And those are the elements that make Jim Leland so special. And when you add the fact that he doesn't want to go anywhere else, he could manage somewhere else for more money, but doesn't want to. He wants to stay right here until he retires. And so when you have that, young players can see stability. And they can see a manager that is dedicated to the franchise, and he's dedicated to helping young players help the organization win. And so that in itself gives them some confidence, knowing that Jim Leland's going to be here. And so when they do something really well, the manager will remember that. It's not as though you did something for this manager and another year or two he's gone, someone else is in here. A lot like the Chicago Cubs. I mean, they have a different manager every year. And so you're constantly fighting for space. You're constantly fighting for someone to have confidence in you, because they don't understand what you've done before. And that's an advantage a young player has with Jim Leland. Plus, he knows the game, knows how to manage, and as I said, has a key ingredient of being able to maintain discipline without losing the respect of his players.
Okay, what would you say your proudest moment was as a Pirate?
As a Pirate, no question, the World Series victory of 1971, when I threw a two-hit shutout. Not only threw a shutout, but got a base hit, drove in a run. I mean, it was a real, real special day. The only other moment that was similar was not World Series, playing a performance like that in a World Series really has to stand by itself, because when you come up with a game like that under that kind of pressure, international exposure, as I mentioned earlier, that it really enhances your reputation, and it's something that I chose to live here after my career was over, And so those memories stay with your fans, and it can serve you your whole life. The other special moment came in the following season. I was pitching against San Francisco, and I pitched a one-hitter. Only one guy got on base. Almost a perfect game. And due to a scoring controversy, a scorer called that one base hit a base hit. It was really an error. And that was the only guy that got on. So I came within an eyelash of throwing a perfect game. That would have been the other special moment.
What was it like playing with a pirate great such as Roberto Clemente and Molly Stargell?
It's any time that you're on a winning ball club, there's a lot of key ingredients that go into making that club a winner. First of all, players have to respect one another. And you have to have the superstars as well as the stars and the journeyman player, your role players, bench players, people who contribute a little bit, but that little bit at key times, can almost make or break your season. But your club is always built around the two, three, or four superstars on your team. And they change in style. When I was with St. Louis, our superstars there were Lou Brock and a Bob Gibson and a Curt Flood, a Roger Maris was there, Orlando Cepeda. It wasn't as though Lou Brock was our speed and stole bases and helped create runs for us. And defensively, he had speed to help us defensively. Roger Maris batted third and got key base hits all over the place. Cepeda was some power, but he also was an outstanding defensive player. So in St. Louis, it was the whole was equal to the sum of its parts. It would have been hard for us to win had any of those parts been removed. In Pittsburgh, with Stargell was strictly a power hitter. Played left field, averaged defensively. Clemente, superstar Hall of Famer. Everything in right field. So he made up for a little bit in left field. We had average defense in center field. But Clemente hit in front of Stargell, get on base, hit with occasional power if he wanted to. Superb arm, he could win ball games by stopping runners from taking an extra base or throwing runners out. Stargell had a very strong arm and could do virtually the same thing. But their major contribution to the 1971 Pittsburgh Pirates is the fact that they could hit and drive in a lot of runs. Stargell hit 48 home runs that year. The most home runs that anyone hit for the St. Louis Cardinals in 67 was 25. So you had different styles of ball clubs. But the superstars are the ones that can elevate your club and carry your ball club for an extended period of time. Willie Stargell did it, Clemente did it, and really shone and carried the ball club in the World Series. So that was very, very special. And when you watch players of the caliber of Clemente and Stargell play every day, that's when you really appreciate how gifted they are. And sometimes their contribution is off the field, a pat on the back to a player who's struggling, empathetic to what's happening. Guy might be having an off year and feels left out because he's not contributing as much in a championship season as well as others. And superstars can sometimes take up that slack for a period of time until that player gets back on track. And that is what happened during our championship years. And really what's evidence, as I mentioned, away from the field contributions, in 1971, our number one shortstop, Gene Alley, was injured, had a bad shoulder, and could not play in the World Series. And the Baltimore Orioles manager, Earl Weaver, made the comment that if the Pittsburgh Pirates had to have Jackie Hernandez at shortstop for all seven games, there's no way that the Pirates could win with Jackie Hernandez at shortstop. Well, Roberto Clemente, and no one knew about it, took Jackie Hernandez aside and just had a little player-to-player chat and build up his confidence, and we're happy to have you and proud that you're going to be playing shortstop. You're going to be one of the heroes of the series, and we can win with you at shortstop. Well, as it turned out, Jackie Hernandez didn't make an error in all seven games of the World Series, And not only that, but he made the last putout of the World Series. A ground ball was hit up the middle, and he went way behind second base as a shortstop fielder of the ball, made an off-balance throw to get the runner at first base, and that was the tying run. So it was a key play of the game, and it was Jackie Hernandez who made it. But that was a contribution that Clemente made. Even though he was the MVP of the World Series on the field, he also, for the Pirates, did one small little thing and helped build the confidence of a player that turned out to be one of our key contributors to a World Series. So they contribute in many ways. Most will contribute primarily on the field, but it's those special ones. And when you win World Series or have championship teams, that's the character that also comes with it. The personality of a team is extremely important in how well players get along, how well they respect one another. That makes for a team that's hard to beat. And that's when you start talking, they'll say, well, this team has a potential of being a dynasty, meaning they're able to win more than one year. When you have those key ingredients, that's when that team can win more than one year. And of course, the team of 71 won in 1970, won a division, World Championship 71, division 72, finished third in 73, but came right back and won a division in 74, and so on throughout the decade, culminating with the World Series in 1979. So it's very special, but those two are the anchors, combined with with Bill Mazeroski, who retired after the 1972 season. When you have those three gentlemen on your ball club, it's special.
What was training camp like that first year after Roberto's death?
It was a very difficult, very solemn camp. Of course, what adds to that is the press is saying, "Who's going to take Clemente's spot? You know, who's going to fill his shoes?" And the answer to that is no one. You just don't go out and find a superstar, and you never fill someone's shoes. You try and get along without them, and that's really, I think, why in '73 we really didn't win. Is we were our team was floundering, because you not only lost. A player who could play defensively for you, but he also hit third right in front of Stargell, and that is just absolutely taken away from you. And so you're readjusting your alignment. You're trying to adjust defensively. Our outfield was average defensively, and now you're going to put someone else in the outfield of less defensive ability than Clemente. So it made your outfield, you know, real average. So it really hurt our ball club, but to lose someone like that is, it's hard to get over. And I don't think in 1973 we really got over that.
So it was more, you think the effect was more personal on a psychological level than
it was really both. It was really all of those elements. Because when you look at the structure of your club, you build them around your number three and number four hitter. And you like someone hitting first and get on base. Well, that was still intact. Dave Cash was our leadoff hitter, or a Gene Kleins, and Al Oliver usually hit second. But now all of a sudden you had to find somebody who was going to hit third in front of Stargell. And if he was a left-handed hitter, you know, then we were going to see a lot of left-handed pitching, and they could more neutralize our number three and number four hitters. So you needed right-handed bat, and all of those it. His death affected our ball club from a talent standpoint, from an emotional standpoint, and a psychological standpoint. And as I mentioned, it took us about half a season before we kind of got our ship righted, if you will. Manny Sanguin tried to play right field, for Pete's sake, and struggled with that. And his arm wasn't as good, different position. And we were really trying to find someone. And finally, the second half of the season, they decided to bring up a young player and let him make a lot of mistakes out there, and that was Dave Parker. So Dave Parker got to the big leagues probably a year or two earlier than he normally would have, but was pressed into service when we weren't going anywhere in 73. And he was brought up, got his feet wet, contributed, and then that was the start of his great major league career.
Who do you see as filling the roles of the superstars of the Pirates in the next few years?
Well, right now, that position is open. We really don't have anyone on our ball club that you would consider a superstar. And I don't know that probably the last two, according to today's standards, that you would have considered superstars would have been Barry Bonds and possibly a Bobby Bonilla. But after they left via free agency, we really didn't have a superstar. And the success of the Pirates without them has been the fact that it's been the whole unit has been able to contribute. And we're looking for young players now to step up and show that that's the kind of player that they can be. So that star and superstar position is wide open and is waiting for some of our young players to seize the opportunity, because it is definitely there.
What do you think, is there a difference in players' attitudes today compared to when you were an active player, as far as team loyalty and like union solidarity?
No, I think the solidarity of players is as strong today as it was in years past. I think for different reasons. In the 60s and 70s, maybe even early 80s, the players were taken advantage of going way back when. But through negotiations, those problems were pretty much solved. And after the 80s, it primarily turned to the financial side of things and salaries. And so your player today does not have the same concerns that the player of the 70s and further back really had. They travel better today and stay in nicer hotels, and their meal money is proportionally better. But salaries have escalated dramatically. Before 1980, if you got a $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 raise for a superb season, I mean, that was huge money. But today's market, I mean, it jumps by millions. And I think that is what has changed. The players today are bigger, stronger, faster. There's better equipment. As I mentioned, they travel better. But I don't know that they play the game better. And to me, there's a difference. I think they're learning to try and play the game better. And as I mentioned, when you're looking for superstars, I think in years past there were more superstars, because baseball wasn't sharing the talent pool as much with other sports as it does today. Because today players can earn a lot of money playing football, playing basketball, playing hockey, playing individual sports. So baseball doesn't have a captive audience anymore as it once did. And you used to have three and four and five superstars on a team, and that was a team that was usually winning quite a bit. And if they weren't superstars, they were at least stars. And I don't think you have as many on teams today because of the talent pool and also because of expansion. There are more teams today than there used to be, and the talent that is in the major leagues is spread out among more teams. But the loyalty factor, I think that's almost an artificial situation. It was nice when they talked about years past there was a lot of loyalty. Well, players had no choice. I mean, there wasn't free agency. You could get buried in an organization, and if they didn't release you, they owned you for life. They owned your rights for life, and as a result, you didn't have any movement. You didn't have, and it was forced loyalty, if you will. But I think that there are, in a lot of cases, both sides were more willing to have a player stay with them for a longer period of time. Years past, you were usually traded when you didn't fit in anymore. As long as you were performing well, you usually stayed with the club, pretty much. But today, you're looking at proving your rosters quickly. The average age and experience of Major League players is younger today. And so you're constantly looking, because you can lose players through free agency, your roster changes more quickly. So I don't think there's as much an opportunity, if you will, for the loyalty factor to exist as it once did.
Do you think the perception of the Pirates and other small market teams as being sort of like a minor league team for the big market teams, you know, like with Barry Bonds going to San Francisco and Bobby Bonilla going to New York? Do you think that's a fair perception? It seems like a lot of people feel like these teams, they bring up the young players, and once they become really good players, they leave and go to the big teams that can pay them more money.
Well, that's exactly what's happened over the years, is that the big markets who have a huge financial advantage over smaller markets have used that advantage to buy talent, not necessarily grow their own, but because there is no regulatory system involved in baseball, and you don't have revenue sharing that much per se in key areas in baseball, that the big teams, the big market teams, earn a lot of extra money. They use that to go buy players. And the disadvantage that you have is small market teams like Pittsburgh are forced to pay New York dollars with Pittsburgh money, and we don't have it. And that's the inequity in the system, and that's what Major League Baseball is going through in these labor negotiations here, is to try and fix that system, and it needs to be fixed. You can't have competitive balance throughout the 28 Major League teams if you have 8 or 9 major markets control the money. I mean, everybody has to have a piece of the action. You almost have a salary cap, because if you overpay or overextend your payroll, you know, then you have to reach in your own pocket. It's not at the expense of other small markets. And so that's one of the things that they absolutely must fix. Baseball no longer has any room to be able to afford these inequities, and they've got to get it fixed. They have to have revenue sharing so that the ownership of baseball and baseball as an industry can look at parity, so that every spring, when every team, every major league team, major markets, small markets, when they go to spring training, they can truly and sincerely say, this could be the year. We've got a chance of winning this. And now when you're looking at making trades before or during the season, and then right after the season, you're genuinely looking for 1 or 2 or 3 players that might make you a winner. But anytime you have the inequity in a system like exists today, you can do all of those things, and you'll have a New York, a Chicago, or LA, because they have the extra money, they'll just go grab the players and take them right away from you. We're an organization that grew our own players. You know, we signed the Bonillas in our minor league system and the Barry Bonds and developed them, spent all the money developing them, and made them pretty fair offers to stay. And in regular circumstances, they probably would have stayed, except that that all of a sudden you get a New York involved, a Chicago involved, L.A., San Francisco ended up coming up with the money that they could literally blow the Pirates out of the water with the, you know, $2 more million a year. Well, it's hard to turn down, you know, over the course of 6 or 7 years, $12 million. And you're only worth it, in my opinion, if some fool is out there willing to pay it. And just because the negative to all of it is that just because you spend the money doesn't mean that you're going to win. And there's great examples in Major League Baseball over the years of franchises that have spent exorbitant amounts of money on free agents and buying talent that never won. The California Angels, Ted Turner down in Atlanta, they haven't won a World Series yet. George Steinbrenner hasn't won since, what, 1978, something like that. So just because you spend the money, there's no guarantee in baseball, because you play every day, 162 games a year, there's no guarantee that you're going to win. But what has happened in the meantime is you've destroyed an industry, because you've gotten salaries and expenses totally out of whack, and now people can't afford to be in the business. So that's what they have to fix, and that's why it's important that these labor negotiations that are going on in baseball right now are done in the right way and come to the proper solution. The proper solution, in my opinion, being they need a revenue share so that everybody can be competitive and be on an equal playing field, and thus automatically creating a salary cap. If a team wants to overspend, then what they're talking about in a salary cap is there's some kind of taxation or penalty for overspending. And I think if they come out with the right numbers, that you'll have a pretty equitable system. And baseball as an industry will be solvent again, and you won't care whether you're in a big market or small market. You're going to make competitive wages regardless of where you play.
So the players that are with Pittsburgh now or the other small market teams, when they get to the status of like Bobby Binney and Barry Bonds, the Pirates would be able to have a chance to keep those players?
Yes,
because
under a new system. Under a new system, because we will have pretty much as much money as the big markets, and it will cost the big markets additional revenue via penalty if they overspend according to the system. And baseball is the only sport, the only major league sport that doesn't revenue share in this way, and that's why the NFL and the NBA have been so successful in the past. And now the National Hockey League is looking at trying to institute a system that's going to make teams that are in smaller markets to keep them competitive financially, so that they can have teams that that will be in the hunt every year. And it's just not the same major markets that are winning every year. You need for everybody to participate in that winning tradition to have a healthy industry.
And the last question I have is, what do you think the future is of baseball in Pittsburgh? And the last part of that question is, what do you think the Pirates need to do to win back the fan support after this strike?
The Pirates should, the selected potential owner, indeed be the owner, I think gives us some stability. It assures the region that the Pirates are going to stay here. Which is very important, and eliminates the insecurity that people might feel about the franchise. So, and part of the key of that sale is the resolution of the labor problems. So if the labor problems are settled, then I think ownership can look at operating a franchise without losing millions of dollars a year. I think they can look at operating on at least a break-even basis and possibly even make a few dollars. So the change of ownership in Pittsburgh and the new labor, potential new labor contract, I think bodes well for small markets like Pittsburgh, so that they can survive and be competitive. It's not enough just to survive, but you have to be able to be competitive and be able to have your share of winning years. That's very important. The second part of your question was what?
How to win back the fans.
How to win back the fans. We've been very proactive. You can't wait for a season to start and then say, well, we got to get the fans back. The first key ingredient for a franchise is its season ticket holder base. And so as soon as the strike was announced on August 12th, we began communicating with all of our season ticket holders. Telling them, you know, that they could get a refund on the unused tickets, that they could apply that toward next year's season tickets if they wanted to. We'll pay them interest on their money over the winter time if they want to leave their money and use it as a credit toward their season ticket purchase of the following year. We just got through on successive Thursdays of holding a reception for all of our season ticket holders that wanted to come, and it turned out to be over 1,400 over a period of three nights, so that they personally could hear from our president and from our general manager and from our manager and all of us who work on the business side of the operations, answer questions, talk about their concerns as season ticket holders and what are we going to do, the benefit packages that we're going to offer, and they've come away from that seeing that we're treating them very, very fairly. Most people understand labor stoppages and strikes and lockouts and all of those things, because it's been, you know, part of American business, you know, forever. So they understand those things. What our fans don't want to see is that now all of a sudden ticket prices escalate, that they can't afford to come to games, and for the third consecutive year we're not raising ticket prices, and so We're one of the best values in all of Major League Baseball as far as our ticket prices are concerned. And then fans look also for a clean stadium, for a secure stadium, a family atmosphere. They look at how do you have fun when you come to the ballpark, and so we make sure that the facilities look good, that our scoreboard is very entertaining, that the Pirate Parrot is doing the right things, and that our marketing is strong. Our marketing meaning our group sales, our season ticket sales, putting together promotions that people like, and we try and do that through targeting youth days and then adult days. And the items that people like to wear, wearing apparel, you know, jerseys and hats and t-shirts, things of that nature are what we try and do. And we try and make them quality so that they will last. It's not something that you can wear at the game and it falls apart. So we look at promotions being an integral part of all of this. And then probably the key ingredient is that you need to put a good ball club on the field. The ball club not only that has some talent, and people understand in our marketplace that we're in transition, that we're looking at rebuilding our club again for the second half of this decade to be a winning franchise. And this time we might be able to keep our players for an extended period of time. But what they want to see is players that like to play, that play hard, that want to hustle, that have the right type of image, that they can look at their sons and daughters and say, yeah, I'd like for you to grow up just like them, rather than having to apologize for the actions of players. And those are the types of players that we look for. And the character issue is very important to us in a small market, because we need for our fans to identify with our players. That's our product. And they will identify with that player if they like the way he plays, but they also like the way that he conducts himself on the field and off the field, the image that he portrays, his involvement in the community, if you will, during the season and in the off season. Those elements are very, very important. And we try to get our young players involved in charitable activities and charitable programs and raising funds that help support these charitable efforts. So all of these elements are really what we're going to be doing to win the trust of our fans. And we want them to understand that we want them to be able to enjoy the game of baseball and do it in a family atmosphere. So we've been working very hard behind the scenes to make sure that when they say play ball, that we're ready to accommodate them and make sure that they come away from Three River Stadium. Whether team wins or loses, they can say, hey, I got my money's worth. And we lost today, but boy, they play hard. They play good baseball. This is good Major League Baseball, and I want to come back. When they come the first time, it's because they love baseball. When they come back the second time, they're saying that they like everything that you're doing. And of course, in a small market, you need them to come back 3 and 4 times. And when they do that, then you've really won the marketing game.
Thank you.